Hello, Lynne Malcolm here with an All in the Mind podcast extra for you. It's a story that's just appeared in the psychiatric journal JAMA about the potential mental health benefits of psychedelic drug research. It's likely that within the next 5 years, researchers will have answered the controversial question of whether the psychoactive drug commonly known as ecstasy, methyldioxymethamphetamine or MDMA, can be used to treat psychiatric disorders. The US-based Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, is coordinating this research. They've had positive results from two small trials of MDMA-assisted therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder, and phase 3 studies are underway. MDMA may be approved for prescription by 2021. Dr. Gerlinda Beatty is Head of Substance Use Research at Origin, the National Centre of Excellence in Youth Mental Health. Her paper, Is Psychiatry Ready for MDMA, the Medicine?, has just been published in JAMA Psychiatry. Here she describes the drug, MDMA.
Chemically, it has relationships with prototypical psychostimulants, so things like amphetamines. It also has chemical links to more classical hallucinogens like mescaline. In terms of its effect, it has three sort of separate components to effects. It has stimulant-like effects, so there is some overlap with stimulants. It has some hallucinogen-like effects, so it produces things like perceptual abnormalities and alterations to senses of space and time. It typically doesn't produce frank hallucinations. They're more subtle effects than that. But the thing that I think people really know MDMA for is these, what they call empathogenic or intactogenic effects. And these effects are things like feeling loving, feeling playful, feeling open to other people and connected to other people, sort of the loved up feelings that people describe.
And this is in the recreational equivalent of it, ecstasy. Are they the same drug? Yeah.
So ecstasy is just the name for what people would like to be MDMA, but because it's an uncontrolled drug, it's often got a whole bunch of other things in it. It may or may not have MDMA in it. It may have other psychoactive drugs in it, like methamphetamine is a very common drug that's in ecstasy tablets, and it may also have a whole bunch of non-psychoactive drugs in it. So they're supposed to be the same drug, but in reality, they're really quite different. So we know that ecstasy users who use it recreationally say that they have all these feelings and this is why they're using the drug. Some of the work that we've done in laboratory administration of MDMA to humans basically shows that you can produce these effects, these feelings of being loved up and intensely social, even in a very bizarre laboratory kind of environment. So people will report feeling very loving even when they're totally alone and about to go into an MRI. So pharmacologically, it does very clearly produce these effects, even in randomised double-blind trials.
And how is this useful in a therapeutic situation, for example, treating post-traumatic stress disorder?
There's two sort of rationales for why you would want to use MDMA as an adjunct to psychotherapy. One is the broader rationale and one is specific to PTSD. So the broader rationale is that these kind of feelings of reducing your defences interpersonally may act as a kind of fast track for the therapeutic bond. And what we know is that across a range of different therapeutic methods for different conditions, that the nature and strength of the bond between the therapist and the patient is often very important in terms of the outcome. So the people who are advocating for this therapeutic use argue that this is like a fast track to that process of bonding with the therapist. In terms of PTSD more specifically, the rationale is around this reduction of fear, so that one of the key components of any kind of psychotherapy for PTSD is engaging with and altering your response to the traumatic memory. So in exposure therapy, for instance, people go through long periods of basically being exposed to smaller and then increasingly larger reminders of the trauma until they kind of integrate it into their normal processing a little more. In the case of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, the idea is that people suddenly feel free to open up to the traumatic memories without the fear that they normally attach to it. And so, it acts as a kind of fast track to allow them to integrate those traumatic memories in a way that they couldn't do when they didn't have the drug on board.
So how far are we away from this in Australia?
So in Australia, I think one of the things that's making us a little bit behind in Australia is that we don't have a history of acute drug administration studies in general. In the States particularly, but also in the UK, there is more of a capacity and an understanding of why we would want to give drugs of abuse to humans in controlled settings. And so there have been no clinical trials approved in Australia yet.
Do you think it's important that Australia gets on board and gets serious about using the potential benefit of these drugs?
I do. My sort of view on it is that what we see in this area, and it's similar with medical cannabis, is that you've got on one side a group of people who are super, super convinced that it's going to work, and they're sort of the true believers, and nothing will dissuade them from that. And then on the other side, you've got sort of a group of people who just think that because ecstasy is an illicit drug and has been, you know, misused and undoubtedly has harms associated with it, it can't possibly have any kind of benefits at all. So I put myself squarely in the middle, which is to say that, you know, PTSD is a really serious problem. If there was something that made a difference for people who had failed other treatments, that would be wonderful. I'm very suspicious of claims of things like penicillin for the soul, which is what one of the advocates has said about MDMA. So I don't think it's going to be a magic bullet. I think that probably the best route that Australia would take is to see what happens with the phase three trials in the States. And if we get a signal in that and it gets approved, then I think there'll be a much better rationale to do something at that point.
We see many stories in the media, horror stories about ecstasy and what happens when things go wrong. How concerned should we be about the risks and dangers of the drug?
I think that we need to be cautious about it, but I also think this, when this drug is used in a controlled setting, the studies that I've done, I've personally administered MDMA to around about 50 people and never had any kind of serious adverse effect. In a controlled sort of setting, it's pretty well tolerated. In some of the horror stories that we've heard, there's a few things to consider about that. First is that the rates of horror stories are actually pretty low comparative to the amount of people who actually use this drug. The second thing is that it's not just the drug that is implicated in a lot of these cases. It's perhaps multiple doses of MDMA. It may be MDMA in combination with a range of other substances. And then there's a whole bunch of environmental factors that feed into some of the toxic effects that have happened. So that's been the situation where that's produce those kind of effects in people using ecstasy. So I don't think we need to worry about it to that extent. But I do think there have been hundreds of people who've undergone these kind of studies in laboratory environments, very controlled studies. I think that was kind of the extreme version of the safest you could see the administration of this drug. If this gets approved for prescription, I think, you know, obviously that's not going to be the way it's going to be used in a lot of cases. So I think the risks do go up a little bit at that point. But again, then the other end of the spectrum is where ecstasy is used recreationally, which is kind of the most risky way you could be using it because it is so uncontrolled and it's combined with so many other factors.
So if MDMA does get approval for prescription, does it open the way to further potential benefits from other psychoactive drugs, such as the therapeutic use of LSD, for example?
I mean, I think it does. I think that's the strategy that MAPS have been using. They're interested in a whole range of different psychedelic drugs. And to me, that's, again, one of the sort of red flags of this movement, because I don't think it can be the case that all of these different psychedelic drugs just are inherently therapeutic. But they essentially selected the most likely candidate to get through the approval process. And then they've spent, you know, 20 years doing this. Once that happens, I think at that point, what we'll see is them falling behind other kinds of research. And there has been a bunch of research done with psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, and also LSD, showing some positive signals. But again, what we're seeing is that these are small studies. They're conducted by people who have an enormous vested interest a lot of the time in showing that they have a positive effect. So I think this, in many ways, is this larger scale trial that's being run by a lot of different therapists, and there's an independent team who are rating the outcome. If we see positive results from this, I think it's going to force a lot of people to accept things that they had been a little bit sceptical about before, myself included. And that way, I think it'll make the transition of some of these other drugs into medications a little bit easier.
So why do you think it's important that an organisation like Origin, which focuses on youth mental health, puts out a statement or gets into the game with the use of these drugs?
I'd like to say, first of all, that this was really coming from my position as a researcher, as a substance use and addiction researcher. So it's more general for me. But I also think that when we see, if we see prescription use in the States, what we're going to see is off-label prescribing, and we're going to see prescribing for young people. So that is something that we need to think about in psychiatry more broadly at an international level. But because we know that young people are a particularly vulnerable group, this is something that we need to think about in relation to, you know, if there was a treatment that worked really well and helped people who weren't responsive to normal therapy, then that would be fantastic. And I think any organisation would need to get behind novel therapies like that. But this also represents a pretty substantive risk group in a way that, you know, there's not been any controlled studies done in adolescents of the effects of MDMA. So while we know it can be well tolerated in adults, we don't know that in young people. So that was sort of my position as someone who is developing this new research line at Origin, is that if we are thinking about doing this kind of research, we need to take into account the perspective of young people as well. I think it's really important that we differentiate between MDMA and ecstasy. And one of the things that's happened in response to some media that I've done in the past about the effects of MDMA has been that people have sort of taken that idea and run with it. And this, you know, this movement for self-therapy with MDMA. And one thing I would really clearly say is that I have seen no evidence that the drug alone does anything particularly beneficial. So I would not encourage people to rush out and give themselves MDMA to treat anything at all.
Dr. Jalinda Baty is head of substance use research at Origin. Her paper was published in JAMA Psychiatry on March the 21st. And look out for further discussion of the therapeutic potential of psychedelic science in coming All in the Mind episodes. And in a few days you can hear our regular podcast called The Art of Neurodiversity. Neurodiversity is a radical social movement challenging the notion of what's normal and what's a disorder. As we accept rich cultural diversity, we can also embrace the full range of ways of perceiving the world. What better place to explore neurodiversity than in the arts and theatre? In this episode, we hear from actors on the autism spectrum and a synesthete using her perceptions of colour and music to create art. I hope you can join me then.